The enemy of the United States is not China. It apparently is not Russia, North Korea, Venezuela, Iran. Apparently, those are only secondary issues. No, apparently, according to the president of the United States, one of the more insidious is the enemy within, i.e., Americans in America. And so now we have this newly declared Department of War, and President Trump appears to be eager to use it on our own citizens here. Now, we're going to get into, there is a very, very legitimate and enthusiastic support for me for law and order and keeping our country safe and providing proper policing and, you know, those sending the criminals to jail, all that, no problem with that whatsoever. But when we start calling our own citizens the enemy within, and we're using the Department of War and telling the senior generals in our country, you guys are going to have a big role in this, we may have some problems here. And we also have some additional information, some new kind of breaking information and additional knowledge about the Charlie Kirk assassination investigation. And we're going to get into that as well. A lot of things to cover today, and we got nobody better to do it with than Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, author at the sonar21.com, son of the new American Revolution on Substack, and great friend of the show. Larry, welcome back as always.
Hey, Danny, thanks as always for the opportunity to chat.
Well, listen, now we want to talk about these two kind of really big issues. So yesterday, with both President Trump and Secretary of War Hegseth's discussion with all of these generals that were in the audience there, that had been summoned from literally all over the world, all four corners of the globe, into this theater to be talked to by their two bosses. And so a lot of the focus was on that, because there was a lot of speculation prior to that that, you know, was this, are they going to talk about some kind of war plan? Are they going to do, you know, is there some other reorganization, something like that? We don't really know. Let me just kind of point that off. All we know is what was publicly announced in these videos that were shown, et cetera. But in fact, let me just ask you that right off the bat. Do you think that what we were shown on these two speeches is all there was?
No. Eve Smith, I'd love to take credit for this, but I have to credit her of Naked Capitalism. She surmised that this was really a cover story in order to bring, and I speculated that CENTCOM commander at a minimum, and maybe the SOUTHCOM commander back to DC to talk in person about upcoming military operations. Yeah, people said, well, they could have done that over secure video. Yeah, you can do it over secure video conference, but normally those, even though they're classified, it, you know, can be top secret level, you still can have casts of thousands or, you know, hundreds, you know, a number of people. And if they had called the CENTCOM commander or the SOUTHCOM commander back individually to Washington, with this whole backstory of we got a significant naval force parked off the coast of Venezuela, and now we've got reports of KC-135s and other kinds of air refueler tankers moving to Europe and then reportedly onward to the Persian Gulf. So that would have created all this attention. And what better way than to have these guys come and have to listen to Pete Hegseth and then Donald Trump for like an hour and 10 minutes. And he didn't cover anything new. You know, when it was over, you felt like, you know, I talk about the Peggy Lee song from the 60s where she sang, "Is that all there is? Is that all there is?" You know, it was, you seriously spent all of this money to bring all of these guys and so a few gals back to Quantico, Virginia, in order for them to listen to a very boring version of a Trump campaign rally speech. Really? That was what this was about? And then you know, Hegseth as well. His speech was demeaning. Yeah. You know, it was just, it's what you would expect of a very junior officer, where they're prone to say stupid stuff. Doesn't say anything about his any combat that he experienced before or his service, but it just shows, you know, he did not have the gravitas, he didn't have the wisdom, and then especially some of the, you know, I engage in crude language, but there's a time and place. That was not the time and place.
Yeah, and you know what, it just kind of came across to me, just in terms of general demeanor, is very condescending, as that I'm the adult in the room. It's almost like, say, a new battalion commander talking to his junior enlisted. Yeah. And they put him in a theater or something like that. He just took command, and he wants to talk to all the privates and the sergeants, maybe the lieutenants, and just kind of talking to them like they were kids, and he's lecturing them on what it is. I actually had seen that in a squadron commander when I was a lieutenant, actually, when he came in and talked to them, and it felt very, very similar. But these weren't lieutenants, and they weren't privates, et cetera. This is the literal command authority across the entire unified commands all over the globe, and it just didn't have a good look and feel to it to me.
Yeah, well, someone told me, I haven't been able to confirm this, but someone said that the stage was set up in that it mirrored exactly the stage that was used by George S. Patton, in the movie Patton, when George C. Scott came up and gave his speech at the outset.
Gary's got that right on cue. There you go. Black and white, or color, as you can see, it's exactly expected to try. And
yeah. So that wasn't a mistake. That was deliberate. So it's part of this propaganda. And unfortunately, you know, General George S. Patton was a very flawed individual. And I guess we can say that Trump emulates Patton.
So I guess in that regard, it was real life mimics art. So I guess that was a good one, but
yeah,
not quite the, I could just imagine the people in the audience were just kind of rolling their eyes. Like, you cannot be serious that you want to try to look like the movie Patton version. But anyway, we'll see where that goes. One of the things that from that speech though, and I'll focus right now on President Trump, because and I'll be honest, I was trying to watch that whole thing in live, and as you said, it was so boring and it was way low energy. You know, it wasn't even a normal campaign
event.
For Trump. So I just had a hard time. I think I watched maybe 40 minutes of it or so, and I just finally said, all right, it was so monotonous and wasn't saying anything at all. I just turned it off. Well, it turns out I turned it off before he got to something that actually was pretty meaningful, which I subsequently found and will now have here to show you. Trump is talking about, as I said in the opening here, now he's been, and as a stage setter, obviously he's already sent troops into Los Angeles and now here in Washington, D.C., which even my own wife has seen these folks here, many of our friends, since we live in this area. And it's had some positive effect on lowering the overall a number of violence acts, but only lowered it, not anywhere near the crime-free that's been claimed.
Right.
And that's only so long as you have uniformed men patrolling the streets. And as soon as that utility runs out, unless you're going to have a permanent military alliance or presence permanently in Washington, D.C., it'll go back to where it was before, because the conditions for actually dropping crime haven't even been addressed. They just put people on the street as a show of force, and that had some impact. But so now he's taken that and saying, we're going to expand it across the country. And he took it a little bit further this time.
I told Pete, we should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military. Because we're going into Chicago very soon. That's a big city with an incompetent governor, stupid governor.
So you're telling all these guys, we're going to use American cities and operations as a training ground for the Department of War. I mean, what do you make of that?
Boy, he does not understand the difference between military power and law enforcement power. When I was at State, I was the deputy director for the Anti-Terrorism Assistance Training Program. And so this program was for training law enforcement, not military. We were training police SWAT teams. And then in the course of doing the military exercises I did with JSOC and SOCOM, one time, 1997, 98, Clinton was in office. Bill Richardson was the Secretary of Energy at the time. It headed up the Department of Energy. And so we did a military exercise that involved a nuclear weapon and a nuclear device that was actually in the United States.
That's scary.
And I was role-playing. I was Secretary Richardson. He's now deceased, so it can't be an insult to him. But I got to see the FBI and Delta Force bomb techs argue over the proper way to disarm a nuclear device. And it came because they have two completely different mindsets. The Delta Force operator was, we're going to use hand entry. We're going to put hands on because we're in a combat environment and we don't have the luxury of waiting for the bomb squad or waiting for the bomb robot. Whereas the FBI was, no, we've got this protocol that we follow and we use the robots and we use, so right there is an illustration that how the military thinks about a problem is entirely different than how law enforcement is supposed to think about the problem. And the first step is law enforcement is to de-escalate, not escalate. Whereas the military side is, if you can counter resistance, you escalate. You don't say, hey, Mr. Badman, would you like put your rifle down and let's talk? No, I mean, it's about using violence. Now, I could understand the deployment of U.S. Military police units because at least they have received some training about de-escalating and being involved with crime. But what Trump's doing with this to me is reminiscent of Bogota, Colombia, circa 2000, 2001, when I was traveling there. Hmm. They had soldiers on every corner, blindados, the armored vehicles on each corner. Yeah, crime was down because they had young guys with automatic weapons out there on the corners that could shoot you. And I contrast that with, my four trips to either Moscow or St. Petersburg. Didn't see any soldiers marching around with guns drawn. Hell, didn't even hardly see any police. And those places were safe. And people say, oh, this is an authoritarian state. No, they're just decent people that know how to live with each other. Mm. So Trump, in revealing that he thinks sending military troops whose job is to kill, destroy, and dominate an opponent, that sending them into cities is great training. I mean, right off the bat, that has got to rank up there as one of the stupidest things he's ever said.
Yeah, that is such a great point to make, that the mentality and the focus is necessarily distinct from the law enforcement as you described and from the military, who Hegseth in his own remarks there, he said, our objective is to kill people and break stuff. That's kind of a slang that's been all of the years I was in the military. They said that all the time, but that is largely accurate. We're sent into a combat zone to destroy the enemy. And as you said, dominate the battle space. That's what you're supposed to do. Right. That's not what the police are supposed to dominate the battle space. They're supposed to make it safe so that you can walk around without any fear. That's what the objective is. And those are two very different skill sets, don't you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's why, former military guys, guys that leave the service and then go into police work, they sometimes have difficulty making that transition because it's a completely different mindset. We illustrated it with blowing up boats off the coast of Venezuela. If you're a cop sitting in a car in Baltimore watching two drug dealers making a deal with somebody who's driven in from suburbia, you don't get to hop out of your car and start shooting them. You go over and arrest them, try to take them into custody. Now, if they pull a gun on you and threaten to kill you, then fine. That's when you escalate for violence. But just because somebody's doing something even illegal doesn't mean that you have the right to use force to kill them. And, you know, I think I said this before, I am shocked and ashamed as an American that not a single one of those generals had the balls to stand up and resign their commission over carrying out an illegal order to kill people in a boat. Yeah. Not one. And, you know, so I don't want to hear any of them whining about Donald Trump and his abuses. You know, man up or woman up. And woman up in this case, because the commanding general in charge of Southcom is a woman. And she allowed murder to take place and didn't say a damn thing. Contrast with a guy, you know, Colonel Larry Wilkerson reminded me of Fred Warner. When they were going to invade, George H.W. Bush was going to invade Panama. And this was back in 1989.
Yeah.
So a lot of the planning for that went on in my, you know, in my branch at CIA. I was there at the time.
Interesting.
The analyst who was working closely with the Directorate of Operations, DO, was involved with a whole series of things to provoke a confrontation. Well, anyway, when it became clear that we were going to invade, Fred Warner was the commander of Southcom. He refused to do it. He said, no, I'm not signing off on that. We're not going to use military force here to go after Manuel Noriega. We can do it. He said, there are legal ways we can go about this. They removed him and put in place Mad Max Thurman. And they didn't call him Mad Max for nothing. So
interesting.
I think Warner's the last general in 36 years that over an issue involving an illegal, unlawful order is the only one to have had the stones to stand up and say, no, I'm not going along with that.
Wow. Well, so let me ask you, because you have some experience in both worlds, or at least some access to them, there is the issue of law and order.
Right.
We do want law and order. We want civilians to be safe on the streets. When it comes to immigration, it's completely legal and authorized for ICE to go and get people who have violated the laws and to arrest them and do all these kinds of things. It's also legal for American citizens to protest peacefully as long as they don't violate any laws in the process. So all of those things are simultaneously. But what is the risk, the thing that we have to be careful, a line that we have to not cross to go from normal policing to using a military mindset to accomplish the same ends?
Well, you know, it is a fine line. You've seen some of the videos of the protesters, you know, wearing the face mask, and they actually come equipped, equipped to riot. And in several of the videos I've seen, the police are not moving at them aggressively. They're backing off. And so they're trying to keep the situation calm. We have a contradiction built into the United States of America. Our country was founded starting in 1775. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous date and year, the Ride of Paul Revere, where we had American civilians take up arms against the governmental authority, and it led to a full-scale rebellion. And for a while, at least, when I was growing up in the school, we celebrated that as the founding of America. But then once we have the government established, this notion of people taking up arms to fight against the government authority, that becomes now terrorism. So, you know, I come from a long line of terrorists, 28 of them fought in the American Revolution. So there has to be room for the legitimate protest. But one of the things that we're seeing, and it's not unique, you know, there are outside forces that are funding and promoting some of this in the same way that the United States funds, supports color revolutions in other countries. So it's not like we got clean hands. We're not in a, we live in a glass house and we're wanting to throw rocks. So putting this, making this into a military confrontation does run the risk of escalating this into something very dark and ugly. We've already been, have lost several of our civil rights, including, yeah. you know, the, particularly the right to privacy, where the government can spy on us, right or left. That it just, whoever's in power has the right to do it to the other side, and that's what we're seeing.
Or they have the capability, whether they have the right or not, maybe a second issue.
Yes,
but they certainly
correct.
Have the capability and the willingness to do so. And that's kind of where one of my concerns about this, one of the reasons I wanted to address it and kind of get your view on these things, because there is a risk, I think, of normalizing military uniforms and armored vehicles, et cetera, in American cities that could, under the wrong set of circumstances, be turned against us, and maybe even legal protest if it's the wrong kind of protest for whoever may be in power at a given time. For example, I mentioned that they've already been to Los Angeles and they are still in D.C. here. Now President Trump was saying the other day he was going to send them to Portland, Oregon to take care of this war zone that's going on up there. And then all these videos came out. They're like, what are you talking about? Even at the ICE facility, there's no war zone. There was like four protesters. One guy dressed like a chicken. That's it. There was no violence or anything. There was right. no fire. So then what is it that prompted sending them there? And then now then we have President Trump yesterday saying this.
It seems that the ones that are run by the radical left Democrats, what they've done to San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, they're very unsafe places, and we're going to straighten them out one by one. And this is going to be a major part for some of the people in this room. That's a war, too. It's a war from within. Last month, I signed an executive order to provide training for quick reaction force that can help quell civil disturbances. And this is going to be a big thing for the people in this room, because it's the enemy from within, and we have to handle it before it gets out of control.
I mean, look, you are flat out saying the Department of War is going to be fighting against the enemy from within. And then you're using as your setup the radical left. That's a political environment. People that you don't like, who don't like you, who are protesting, et cetera. And now you're setting up a QRF, Quick Reaction Force, which is, I'm sure you know better as much as anybody else, but in the military, we had a QRF in most of our areas so that if there is an enemy unexpected show up, especially when we were doing counterinsurgency stuff, we had a quick reaction force so that we can, if something happens, you can immediately send in physical violence and force to quell that right away. And for that to be your, I mean, it's not even, in fact, I'd like you, if you would, first of all, to distinguish between a military QRF and a SWAT team, which also has a lot of power in civilian enforcement.
Yeah. So, and it's evolved over time, but let's go back to the Vietnam era, where if a unit, whether, you know, company size, you know, 150 guys or even a battalion was moving out into an area of high contact, and they were at the point of being overwhelmed. The movie We Were Soldiers, illustrates that the best. Well, part of this whole quick reaction force was you had both artillery that could be zeroed in, that could come and provide supporting fire. You had another company size element potentially that could load up on helicopters and then be dispatched to the area to reinforce it on the ground. And you had combat air that could come in and do close air support. That evolved. We saw the disaster of it during the Afghan war operation. I think it was called Red Wing, where, you know, the four SEALs got trapped out there and three of them got killed and Marcus Luttrell, you know, ran away, and they sent out a quote quick reaction force, which is like 18 guys, a lot of them SEAL Team 6 members, on a helicopter, and they got shot down.
I remember that. I was there at the time.
Yeah. And, you know, that was just, you know, there was a stupid quick reaction force. Well, anyway, to talk about that in the context of crowd control, because again, the military, when it comes in to fight an enemy, is using violence. They're not using tear gas.
Yeah, and in fact, while you're talking this, Gary, if you can bring up that one, that Trump Truth Social, this is part of the problem, just the impression. This is what he posted when he was talking about sending people to Chicago, this AI generation of him. You talk about the Vietnam scenario. This is kind of what he showed there. Gary's pulling that up. Yeah, this Chicopolypse Now, you know, from the movie. And you see that Chicago's about to find out why it's called the Department of War. And you see that. I mean, there's fire in the back. There's military helicopters coming across, whatever. That's not, that doesn't give the impression of policing. That gives the impression of a war, which is exactly why he specifically said that. That's not congruent with civil policing to keep our people safe. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, no, it's offensive. Robert Duvall ought to sue him for copyright infringement, or Francis Ford Coppola, you know, because Robert Duvall played that character in the movie. It is, again, for Trump to use that kind of imagery, it is either, despite having attended military school as a, you know, as a teenager, he doesn't understand a damn thing about the military. And he certainly doesn't understand anything about law enforcement. He thinks this is all, it's all about just, you know, pure unadulterated power. I find it, it's not just offensive. It's dangerous because it cultivates, at least among some Trump supporters, that, yeah, this is okay. No, that's not okay.
Yeah.
And again, we're the generals that had the balls yesterday to stand up, Mr. President. No. Yeah. Demote me, court-martial me. This is wrong what you're saying. Not a one of them.
Right. And you know, and specifically because it was in the context of that soundbite I just showed you here, he's talking about, he loves that phrase, the radical left. And he's talking about the enemy from within. It's not a big leap. And in fact, I think it's intentionally so, especially among some of his supporters, to draw that line that the enemy from within is the radical left, which is everyone who happens to be in the Democratic Party, or it can be. And that's the real problem. Then you're talking about using military power.
Yeah.
I'm very concerned about these, even though I'm all for having law enforcement and being safe in those cities that he mentioned. I want that. And I want the secure borders, and I want people who have violated the laws to be subject to our normal judicial system. But I don't want to demonize a category of American people.
Yeah. Well, and again, I can't emphasize enough that when that played, and when he finished saying that, that not one single general in the crowd stood up and walked out. Not one. And, you know, so we want to talk about lack of courage. You know, yeah. Is it, am I painting the whole crowd with a brush? You bet your ass I am. You know, because that was a defining moment right there.
Yeah.
Because what he said, they know better, or they should know better if they're in the command positions that they are, of what is a legal order vice an illegal order. And that, yeah, we're going to get you guys up to train to deal with the enemy here within the United States. Yeah, a lot of this has been, as we saw, has been government sponsored in the past. We saw, for example, on January 6th, now over 200 FBI and government assets in the crowd. For what purpose? To control the crowd? No. To stir the crowd up so that it did what it did, in order to create an incident to justify the government doing something. That was done while Donald Trump was president, for God's sake. So that tells you that there are deeper, darker forces in this government that have other objectives at heart, that it's not just Trump. But Trump, he's getting played like a violin. And he, you know, they feed him the music, and he happily, you know, like an organ grinder monkey, man, he dances.
Yeah, not a good situation to be in. In the time we have left, I want to shift gears, but staying in the context of law enforcement. And I want to look at something I know you've talked about. I think we've talked about you've on our show, but you have some new stuff on sonar21.com about the Charlie Kirk assassination investigation. I want to kind of set the stage here for some of the information that you've put out, and I'd like you to talk about some of the specific forensics, especially about the weapons usage and the type of rounds that are claimed to be used. Let me set the stage first of all. NBC News reported, one of many, that shortly after the suspect had been identified as Tyler Robinson, is that they said that there was a powerful vintage weapon. They said here, and you see that it was a .30-06 caliber rifle, a Mauser type model 98, which is a bolt action, not even a semi-automatic. There was another later on that they actually showed a photograph of what they said was the recovered rifle. And then you see it right here. So it's an old one. They said it was used in the World Wars, if I'm not mistaken, or some variant of it. And then we have this claim that that's a .30-06. We're going to show some videos that I found on your website about what a .30-06 bullet will do when it's fired from relatively close range, which this one was. In fact, let's go first of all to this the X post by the chief of staff for Charlie Kirk, who acknowledged one of the big problems that a lot of people said, hey, there's evidence, the video shows that there was no exit wound. So we're told that the sniper fired from the front went into his neck with a .30-06, and there was no exit wound, which if you know anything about bullets, even if you know a little bit about bullets, you're like, wait a minute, it went into a neck and didn't even come out the back. And here's what Andrew Colbert said. I just spoke with the surgeon who worked on Charlie in the hospital. He said the bullet absolutely should have gone through, which is very normal for a high-powered, high-velocity round. That's important. We're going to talk about that more in a minute. I've seen wounds from this caliber many times, and they always just go through everything. This would have taken a moose or two down, an elk, etc., but it didn't go through. Charlie's body stopped it. His bone was so healthy. This is also important here. I'm going to show you in a second with this video, and the density was so impressive that he's like the man of steel. In the end, the coroner did find the bullet just beneath the skin. So let me run to the remember those things. .30-06. It was stopped because of his neck, and he's the man of steel. Okay, so now here were a couple of guys who said, "All right, let's go out and take a look and see what a .30-06 with a bolt action rifle would actually do in similar circumstances." Watch this.
We're not only going to take a cow femur, but for anybody that says, wow, there's no meat, we're going to slap on a fat 4 inches of beef in front of the cow femur and see what happens.
And then give him thick skin like Nate.
All right, last test on the meat. Again, cow femur, bunch of beef, thick tape, and then we're going to move up to the steel. Here we go. Well, we can't. Everything exploded. All right, let's check it out. Cow femur. The damage to that literally snapped in half.
Okay, now Gary, if you could pull that other image of the at the moment of shot. This is what we have been told is a .30-06 from a bolt action rifle from relatively close range, and the neck stopped it. Can you explain to us what we're seeing here?
Yeah, well, what we're seeing doesn't match up with what we're being told. There is no way that rifle that was shown, number one, I'm not sure it's a vintage rifle. It looked like it had a polymer receiver and stock, but if a .30-06 had hit Charlie in the neck, the head would have exploded. It would have been one of the most horrific scenes that anybody had ever witnessed. Instead, he was shot with something that did. All we can do is go by what we saw his body do. What we saw his body do was he initially started moving forward. His shirt poofed up and out in the front and back. You know, this it was very rapid. If you realize that 1 second of film and 1 second of that video is 30 frames of vidicule. So in literally 1/30th of a second, his shirt pushes out and in the back and front, and yet there's not an exit wound. We then see blood start pouring from the neck. Now, I don't know if in your combat, if you ever saw anybody with an arterial wound, but anybody that's had an artery cut, as the heart is pumping, that blood is spurting out. It's like a squirt gun. It comes out. Well, that entrance wound of that bullet should have, it severed the carotid, I'm sure. But in the time, literally, as that bullet entered into his neck, it reportedly hit the spine and then it went downward trajectory, and it's called cavitation. It's like an internal explosion. And in that literally 1/30th of a second, it destroyed his heart. That's why you don't see blood pumping out of his neck. And, you know, I posted at Sonar 21 a short video of a deer getting shot where you can see the cavitation ripple through the body, and it killed the deer. Well, that's what happened to Charlie. So the odds are he was hit with a round, because I got information yesterday as well from another good friend. And he had spoken with a senior person at TPUSA, someone who's in a position to know. And the person at TPUSA said, actually, what happened is the damage that was done to the spinal cord, and they found bullet fragments, not the bullet intact, but bullet fragments, which is consistent with what's known as a frangible bullet. Those were initially designed to be used by police, along with hollow points, so that they wouldn't pass through an individual that had been shot and, you know, and hit some innocent bystander behind. So when you match all of that up, some other kind of weapon was used to kill Charlie Kirk. Not the story the FBI is telling us is a pure lie.
Okay, and see, now that also lends itself to another problem. Gary, if you can put that X post back up there again. Look carefully what was said by Andrew Colvett. He said, I just spoke with the surgeon in the hospital, and he said the bullet should have gone through. It was a high-powered, high-velocity round. That is not the kind of round that you're saying this other person right. Who's saying, so somebody's not telling the truth here, because a high powered bullet will not stop. I don't care how thick your neck is. It's not going to go through. And in fact, he said in that he called him a man of steel. Well, in that same group of people that were doing those videos here, they said, well, let's see what happens if we shoot that round at steel.
All right, so let's check out what 30-06 did to literal steel here. We have our, and thank God we got an actual competition shooter here to hit this 2-inch by 2-inch plate from 100 yards, which I probably wouldn't have been able to. Clean through 1/4-inch steel. Clean through 3/8-inch steel and 1/2-inch steel almost, or actually it potentially did actually blow out the side of that.
Yeah.
That is up to 1/2 inch of steel. It is physically impossible for correct. What this guy said to have been true. What do you make of these incongruities?
Yeah, well, he's getting lied to. He doesn't have any experience with firearms. So you accept that the doctor must know what he's talking about. And, you know, this evidence is coming out now. Well, as we look at what they claim is the evidence. But then you match it up against real world, because here you've seen, by the way, the guy doing that, he broadcasted a channel called Valhalla VFT. He's a retired special forces sergeant and you know, had a number of combat tours. But they basically challenge these guys because they hear that. No, listen, we've seen people shot with this round, and the story they're telling about Charlie Kirk does not add up. And so as you begin to just see the actual video evidence, you know that there's no way it could have been a 30-06. Yet that story is being put out there. And it'd be bad enough if they said, well, we're still, you know, they were out early making the claim that it was this 30-06 rifle.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, this tells me this is a constructed narrative.
Right.
And why is the question?
That is the question. Gary, if you could put that one of the actual weapon that's claimed, the alleged weapon that was used, that they said this is what they found in the woods. Now, tell me from looking at this, because you're more weapons expert than I am. This looks like a solid weapon. You know, this does not look like something that you can take apart and disassemble rapidly.
Correct.
And yet, in that video that allegedly is the shooter running off the roof, in that whole scene, and we've shown this on the show before, when he runs all the way across into the grassy area, all the way after he gets off, you don't ever see any of a long rifle like this. And the claim was been oil. He had it disassembled and he had it in his backpack.
Yeah.
But how's that rifle, unless he reassembled it when he put it back in the woods, it's not. So you would have had to seen it somewhere. And he walked past people. If he'd have been carrying a rifle, people would have saw it. They walked past, sure. But that didn't happen. What do you make of that?
Well, and again, there is a version of the Mauser out there, but that wasn't it. That actually detaches. You know, if you look at the front of that optic, the front of the scope that sits on top of the barrel, about 6 inches in front of it, there's actually a piece that you can lift up, and it disconnects the rest of the barrel from the receiver. If you had that kind of Mauser, yeah, you could break it down, but that's not it. So this one, you would have to take, my understanding is there are two screws under the, you know, what we look at that wood part that the barrel sits in, it's called the receiver, that there are two screws that you take out, and that can't be done rapidly. You know, that takes some time. So yeah, the entire story. So not only does the claim about the ease of breaking the rifle down not hold up, but the kind of caliber the kind of bullet that is fired out of that rifle doesn't explain what we saw, because we would have seen something much more horrific and terrible. And, you know, with Charlie, I noticed early on, right as he's shot, you see this immediate stiffening. And that stiffening is characteristic of damage to a spinal column, to a cerebral cortex. And so that all tracks now with, you know, hypothetically, a bullet like a 300 blackout, which comes in both frangible and soft tip, could have been fired and done the damage. And if it's fired like it looks like it's fired at about a 20-degree angle, that would have been the bullet enters here, but then immediately hits the spinal column and the cavitation on it. Again, we're talking 1/130th of a second.
And I'm sorry, could you explain for our viewers what is frangible? What kind of round is that?
It looks like it's lead, but it actually when it hits either into skin or, you know, metal, it breaks up. It goes into pieces. So it doesn't stay intact like a hard bullet. It's devastating when used as a defensive round, because the pieces spread out and shred a whole variety of tissue. So a frangible bullet could have done the kind of damage. The other thing we see, though, in the video with Charlie is literally within, after that first 1/130th of a second that he struck, his chest swells and his neck swells. It's like he'd been pumped suddenly with air that expanded, and then it contracted.
And that would be the cavitation. Is that correct?
That is the cavitation. Exactly right. So, you know, now it's starting to make sense. But what doesn't make sense is the story the FBI is telling. And there's a good video out by Chris Martinson that goes over some of this. And, you know, if they ever bring Tyler Robinson to trial, hell, I could be his defense attorney. All I got to do is bring in the video by Chris Martinson. Jurors are going to watch that. All you have to do is create reasonable doubt that Tyler was the shooter. That would do it right there. There is no way that they're going to be able to have a successful prosecution of this kid. And what his role was in all of this, we don't know, because it's not even clear if he was up on the roof. And the videos of him coming across the roof, when he comes out from behind that building, see right there, when he gets to the edge of that white thing, if you look closely, the shadow before when he was on the dark portion of the roof, the shadow disappears. And then as you're, it's a little tough to see, but
yeah, I do. I see where there's a shadow there. I can see it even on the gravel, but now he gets to the white part. Where'd the shadow go?
Yeah. Shadow disappears. And if you
look at that,
as he's starting to climb down off the roof, look in the background, you'll see this guy walking way back there in the background.
Yep.
On the sidewalk. Then he disappears.
Holy crap. Yeah. Gary, run that back. Look at that.
So this video has been tampered with.
Wow. I had missed that part.
Yeah. So they're lying. They're absolutely lying. And you got to say why.
That is crazy. And of course, there you can see there is no assembled rifle. You can see there's not one there.
Yeah. You got, now I showed, I posted on Sonar 21 a picture of a short-barreled rifle. Actually, I have one, and it is it shoots 300 blackout, and you know those can easily fit into a backpack. In fact, I should have brought it here and you know showed it on screen, but it's this big.
You know? Yeah, I saw the picture of it on Sonar 21, but that's not what it used. So then you probably don't have the answer
that's
to this.
That's what could have been used. Something
it
like
could that. Have been.
Yeah.
But we're told something that
yeah,
it
we're
really
told something completely different.
Been.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then what, do you have any theory? And I know we're running short on time here, but do you have any theories on what would have, where could the shot have come from if it wasn't him on the roof?
Well, it's not my theory. It's Chris Martinson presents it. He says it actually came from another building that was about, you know, would have provided a 20 degree angle at Charlie Kirk. So it would have been to Charlie's, to his left. It would have been if it really like let's call it a 45 degree angle. Whereas what the FBI is claiming is that this Tyler Robinson was almost at a 90 degree angle. So there is another line of sight. But the ballistics, even if Tyler Robinson was in the position that he claimed he was in with a 30-06 Mauser rifle, that wasn't the shot that killed Charlie Kirk. It was something different. And there have also been these stories, oh, it was an exploding microphone. Okay, have you ever fired anything, gun, cannon, you know, where you detonate it and the thing that it was detonated from moves forward? No. Everything is like when you fire a pistol, the pistol comes back at you.
Yeah.
And so they're wanting to maintain that this microphone that was clipped on Charlie was one of those Israeli exploding microphones or pagers. Except when the shirt does this, this microphone goes, whoa, moves over in the direction.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was
not only that, but then if what they said was true, then that there would have been an entry wound there, and that was allegedly the exit wound. But then there would have been blood here too, and there wasn't ever exactly. In a white shirt. You couldn't have hidden it, and there wasn't.
Yeah. So, you know, it's incumbent upon American citizens, regardless of your political standing, to demand answers on this. I was not a Charlie Kirk supporter. You know, I paid attention to him occasionally with some of his debates. I found him entertaining, but I had no idea how big his movement was or paid much attention. But this was a political assassination. This was an organized effort. This was not some lone nut gunman. And the efforts and the incompetence now demonstrated by the FBI in the wake of this, as well as local law enforcement, raise a lot of questions about what the hell was going on.
Yeah, and so far we haven't had an answer, but there, it's very disturbing the ramifications of this. I mean, the obvious question is who would have ordered this? And I know there's lots of theories that it could have been the Israelis or several other things like that. I don't know. I don't have any idea at all, other than that the evidence clearly refutes what we're being told, but it's unclear yet what it was. But it's concerning because especially if the FBI and law enforcement seem to be working together to craft a narrative, then that implies that there's a different real narrative. And, you know, I think we deserve that.
Right. They were out very quick with the alternative narrative. And in fact, you know, fed us the story that this was all about some 22-year-old kid who was upset that his older trans lover was being disrespected by Charlie Kirk. And there's actually, you know, no evidence to support that other than that weird series of text messages that are put out where he was talking about his vehicle and his outfit. You know, they've actually found a police body camera footage of him, Tyler, like 2 years ago when he got pulled over in his car for, you know, a traffic accident or something. And he refers to it as his car, not his vehicle.
Yeah, no one talks like. In fact, you look at that whole exchange, and I saw one video by a law enforcement expert who analyzes these kinds of things, and he said this: there's so many inaccuracies and inconsistencies with this that would it's unlikely, very significantly, that a millennial would have spoken like this to his alleged gay lover. So I that's just another one of the big red flags for me.
Yeah. So this. Accused of you're promoting conspiracy. No, I'm just saying, look, you know, the only we know three or four basic facts. We know the fact that there was a gunshot. We all heard it. We know the fact that a bullet entered Charlie's body and did not exit. We have no evidence of an entry and exit wound. We only have one hole going in. We know from the video that his body increased in size and then decreased in size. And then after that, he began bleeding profusely, like somebody had turned on tap water, and he was dead in an instant. That's all we actually know factually.
Yeah.
We don't know where the shot actually came from. We don't know precisely what round was used. We don't know precisely what rifle was used. And we don't know, you know, anybody that was going to carry out that shot had to have done some reconnaissance. You would have had to done reconnaissance on the area, and you would have had to have some knowledge about exactly precisely where Charlie was going to be seated. Candace Owens yesterday raised the possibility that people within the Turning Point USA organization actually may have been involved with this. And you know what? Turning Point USA is the only one that had the information about where Charlie was going to be seated, what the position of the chair would be, et cetera. So that if someone's going to be conducting pre-reconnaissance to check the spot out,
line of shot and all that.
You've got to take that into account is one thing to look at.
Let me ask you this. I couldn't find the video just before we came on here, and I wish I could have. I would have loved to have had it on there. But there was one thing that I have seen. I have not – a lot of this stuff has been talked about on a bunch of channels. But one thing I haven't seen, but which to me from – again, from a physical security perspective and the security team behavior, something was really out of place to me. And that is there was a guy standing – in front of his chair in a plaid shirt. And when the shot goes off, a lot of people have been talking about it. Allegedly, they passed something along to somebody else. But the thing that really stood out to me that something was amiss was the guy when the shots fired, he's allegedly security for Charlie Kirk, right? He's out there providing in front of the audience, et cetera. When the shot is fired, he turns around and leaps over the table and then runs out the back. And allegedly he gets something from one of the other guys, but forget about whether that did or didn't happen. What, and I'm asking, this is a question, what possible reason would a security detail have in the event that the principal was shot to not even look at the boss, run right over him and run out the back door that I didn't see any time after that? What do you think?
Well, if they had a security protocols, for example, say in case of a gunshot, this is what we do. You know, your job is to go here and get the vehicle, as an example. That could be one thing. So I don't read as much suspicion into that because, you know, these teams, in theory, they're supposed to practice a whole variety of contingencies that you brief in advance about, you know, if there's a bomb that goes off in the crowd, what do we do? Who does what? Who's got what mission? If perchance Charlie is shot. What do we do? Who does what? Who applies first aid? Who gets the car? Who, you know, they should have probably had an ambulance pre-staged. You know, with hindsight, we're all geniuses. They didn't. But, you know.
I'd like to see what was the plan before. Don't tell me after the fact, but what was your plan before? What were these guys responding? Because if they rehearsed it, then that means there was a plan. I'd like to see it.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. And this, it was still a bit chaotic. I saw the one guy jump over the table and looked like they grabbed something off of Charlie.
That's him actually right there. The guy just on the right side of that. There he is now.
Yeah, he goes around. There he is right there. He goes around the other side to open the door.
So, but that's the guy that immediately ran past him. Didn't even look to see how he was. He just ran past him. So if that was part of the protocol, I'd like to know where he went and see that validated by something of before the incident. And if it's legit, cool, it's legit, but I'd like to see it. Well, listen, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut it short here. We have some other shows we got to get ready for, but really, really appreciate you coming on today. These have both been very fascinating stuff that we've been talking about today, and super appreciate your views.
All right, my friend. I always appreciate it. Thanks.
And we'll look forward to seeing you very much on the next time. And in fact, if you can join us back in about an hour, we're going to have Colonel Doug McGregor back with us for a second time this week. We're going to go into some depth on something that was talked about yesterday by Secretary of War Hegseth to his generals in a plan to actually reduce by 30% a lot of the generals. And as it turns out, Colonel McGregor has this a plan to how you would do that effectively as opposed to something haphazardly in part of an overall strategy. Absolutely, what he's got to say here is absolutely fascinating. You're not going to want to miss that. Join us at 2 p.m. today. Colonel Doug McGregor also talking about, and actually that's only part of what we're going to talk about, and Larry mentioned it here before, is that there has been some activity that makes it look like we're actually preparing for combat as well. Don't miss that. 2 p.m. today. Daniel Davis Deep Dive. See you then.